The Christina Borgeson Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We're going to take you on a trip down a rabbit hole today, my guest and I, because for a while now, both of us have been looking at the profoundly disturbing issue of mass shootings, mass school shootings in particular. And there are signs and patterns that point to the very real possibility that these events are not only not random, but connected to each other in some way. Greg Reese is here to talk about the hidden connections among the mass school shootings that he's uncovered. His digging has yielded some fascinating information, and I have some of my own information to share with him and all of you. Stories like this become rabbit holes because so much key information is withheld or suppressed, while a great deal of false and conflicting information is widely circulated. Reese produces and reports for his own show, The Reese Report, as well as for Infowars.com. Beyond that, he does have a Renaissance man's background. He's a carpenter, musician, filmmaker, and writer who served as a saw gunner in the Marine Corps. So he's also a Marine, because my son's a Marine, and I know whether you're in or out of the Marine Corps, once you're in it, you're always a part of it. Anyway, he helped build a Tibetan Buddhist temple and worked as night guardian in a yoga shrine before beginning his reporting career. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So I want you to talk about when you first started reporting on school shootings and how your work progressed. I mean, what you were finding along the way. So, and give me good details, you know, talk about who you talked to and what documents you found, et cetera.
Well, I've only done of the hundreds of reports I've done over the past few years. I definitely did a recent one on school shootings, and I don't remember exactly what it was in the past, but I know I've done a couple other that touched on it. I would say my best experience with them is almost personal life experience, and as a civilian when they were happening, as they were following. And what I mean by that is, some of this might sound shocking to some people, but I wrote this. I documented all this in a book in 2017 I wrote, and so it's available for everyone. And I believe that the most important thing right now is the First Amendment. And I believe that this is a very common thing that people just don't talk about, or maybe not very common, but more common than people think. And people just don't talk about it. So I was born in 1970. That puts me at about 52 years old right now. And when I was in grade school, or no, it was high school for me. When I was in high school, at a young freshman, would have been 1985, there really weren't any school shootings back then that I remember. I don't remember hearing. The first thing I remember hearing about school shootings as we know them today was Columbine, which right. is why I primarily focused on that in my report. But when I was a freshman in high school, I suffered an immense amount of anger that I now know, at the time I didn't understand what it was. I now understand it was from traumatic events that happened at a young age that affected me dramatically throughout most of my life. It really sort of guided my life. In many ways, it's what brought me to where I am today as a person that questions these things as a job.
But now, when you say could you talk a little bit about that? Are you willing to share some of the details of that with us?
Of
the trauma that you're talking about that made you such an angry person in high school.
Yes, I guess I could start there. That's this might sound a bit shocking to some people, but I've written about it and I've mentioned it a few times in some interviews before. But so what happened was, when I was 5 years old in 1975, I had an uncle who was graduating as a Jesuit priest. And the family went to Toronto to the Jesuit house to watch the graduation and all that. And I was 5 years old. And the Jesuit priests invited me to spend the night in the Jesuit house while my family stayed in the hotel. And as strange as that sounds to me now, as strange as all of this sounds to me now, the family was like, sure, let them, you know. So I stayed in my uncle's room. And for decades, the memory was, I would say, suppressed, but it was more, I thought it was a dream. For many, many, many years after this event, I remembered it clearly, but I called it a dream. And I always said it was the strangest dream because it seemed so real. And this dream, actually, there was a feeling, an emotion that came with this dream that deeply affected my life, that caused me to sort of hide from reality in drugs and promiscuity, mm-hmm. which is a very common result of young traumatic abuse. But in my 30s, I started having memories. And then what I remembered was being in this room, huddled up in the window in the middle of the night, shivering in fear and completely traumatized, which is obviously a strange memory to have. So I started, this was as a result of meditation. I started a meditation practice, and that's how I kind of started to calm the mind and become more present and started remembering things. So the memory is no different than the dream that I used to talk to my friends as a young kid about this dream. And as a matter of fact, I will tell it to you now as I told it to my friends when I was a kid. And this is how I wrote it in the book, because I'll tell it to you as the 6, 7, 8 year old Greg used to tell it. So the dream was I was in this room, a cold, dark room, as if it was like in a basement. You could feel the dankness. And I was surrounded by adults wearing black robes. And there was an altar in the middle of the room that I was standing in front of everyone at the base of this room by this altar. And there was an adult next to me. Everyone had black robes. You couldn't see anyone's faces. There is a woman on this altar who looked lifeless. She could have been drugged. She could have been asleep. She could have been pretending. Who knows? She had a blanket over her, like a black cloth over her. The person next to me told me that we are all gods and we want to make you a god as well. And so in order to become a god, you need to help this woman. She needs your help. And you need to, and he instructed me to stick the knife inside of this woman. And he put the knife in my hand, and I still distinctly remember, not wanting to do it, but I also didn't want to disappoint all these people. And so I sort of pretended. And I remember even like kind of looking out of the corner of my eye to see if I was fooling them. You know, I was just sort of gently poking and half-heartedly just sort of faking it, thinking I can get away with it. As a child would probably do, and that was followed by a overwhelming sense of disappointment, to say the least. Like, and that was the emotion I carried with me for many years, was this feeling of this entire room disgusted with me. Like it was as if I wasted everyone's time and I was just a complete and utter failure. And this sense of being a complete and utter failure is interestingly sort of followed me for many years. And when I would remember this event, I was able to feel that emotion deeply of like, you are just a worthless failure kind of thing.
What happened the next morning when you woke up?
I don't remember, but when I had this memory, I contacted my uncle, who I don't think my uncle was aware of any of this. My uncle is kind of known for having brain damage. He's an interesting guy. He's a very, very intelligent person, but he's also a very simple-minded kind of person. And I don't think he had any idea. When I checked in with him and asked him what he thought, after telling you what my memory is, I think it's kind of interesting what he told me, because he said, oh, well, you ended up sleepwalking out of the room in the middle of the night, and you were gone for a while, and then you were later returned by Father so-and-so. I can't remember the guy's name. This was back in 2006 when I was remembering, when I was going through all this. And he told me the father's name, who returned me to the room. And then he said,
"Hold up now. He woke up and saw you weren't there, and he just waited until you came back."
Yeah, I guess so. And that doesn't surprise me, because like I said, he's a strange, kind of a weird guy. And then and I don't remember saying this, but what my uncle apparently remembers was that that morning before I left, I said I had a great time and I can't wait to come back.
Which is like
after I was already kind of going through, my memory was being traumatized in the window and then having a suppressed memory and then the room. So just hearing that I said that, you know, I don't know if I don't believe I said that, but I don't think I said that. I think that that's, well, who knows? But for many years.
So why do you connect this experience? And it's very interesting to me. I understand the anger and stuff later on in high school, but then why in the world is that? Why you joined the Marine Corps? Because you figured
that's exactly why I joined the Marine Corps. So before we get to the Marine Corps, I'll answer your question on the school shootings thing. So following this, I grew up thinking I was crazy. I grew up with an immense amount of anger. I didn't trust anyone in any authoritative position. It didn't matter.
Did your parents notice this?
Not that I'm aware of. They noticed I got in trouble once for drugs, and the school notified them, and they had a serious talk with me. And I was a clever kid, so I learned at that point to keep things from my parents. I learned, okay, if you don't want to get in trouble, you have to be a little more sneaky. And I was good at that. So they didn't seem aware. I had an incredible amount of anger. I didn't trust anyone. It didn't matter if you were my parents or someone else's parents or a teacher at school or someone on the TV. If you were in a position of authority, I just assumed you were a lying, bad person, you know? And then at the same time, I would also question myself, because I would be like, why? I was like, I was also aware that I was extremely paranoid. So I thought I was crazy. So when I was 15, going back to when I was 15 and I went to high school, I was overwhelmed with an amount of anger where I would fantasize about shooting the school up. I didn't have
a
firearm. My parents didn't own firearms. I think in Boy Scouts, I trained with a .22 rifle, but other than that, I don't really have any experience, but I was overwhelmed with it. Like
And you never spoke to anybody about it? You never
said, I did. What I did was after several weeks of feeling very disturbed by it, I told my parents, I said, I think there's something wrong with me and I don't know what it is. Half the time I want to go on a homicidal spree. And then that's followed by suicidal thoughts, because then I think then I start thinking I'm a horrible person for having those thoughts. So then I want to kill myself. And so I said, I think I'm dangerous. I think I might kill myself. And so I asked them to take me to the hospital. Back then in 1985, they still had mental wards for teenagers and children.
Yeah.
So they took me to the hospital, and they immediately admitted me into the mental hospital. And it was in there that it was actually through prayer and through a friend on the outside in Alcoholics Anonymous, who actually sort of, that was the beginning of me sort of getting over that. It wasn't the mental hospital didn't necessarily help, because they, even in 85, I think it's good. I think we need to have mental hospitals again. But even in 85 with a mental hospital, it was pretty messed up. Like the psychiatrist was trying to blame it all on my parents. And right away, I knew that that was not going to go anywhere. They didn't try to prescribe drugs, luckily, back then, but I'm sure they would have. I'm sure that was.
Oh,
next.
Yeah. You
but
would I, have been in a hot minute if it were today and the same thing happened.
But I insisted on. I insisted on getting out, and that was actually an issue. And luckily I had a friend who had a friend who was kind of a high powered psychologist who knew some lawyers, and he managed to get me out. And
how long were you there?
I was only there for a month, but a month was long enough for me to recognize that this was not what I needed. Yeah. And so luckily I ended up with what I did. I ended up with a very, Rudy Sullivan was his name. And he was a very, very loving World War II vet. And he was great. And like from day one, he was like, why do you think you're crazy? And then I told him, and then his response was he just started telling me some outrageous stories of his own that, you know, your average person would think he was crazy, you know, and that's what I needed. I just needed to sort of lighten up and realize maybe this is just a human thing. And so, yeah, then a few years later, the anger, I was able to sort of get my grips on it to a certain extent. But by the time I was 19, Desert Storm was happening, or Desert Shield, which was before Desert Storm. And that to me looked like World War III. And so, yeah, like you said, I joined the Marine Corps because to me it seemed like, well, maybe this, I just need to get it out of my system, you know? And luckily the war started and ended while I was in boot camp. So once again, God spared me from having to.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you trained as a SOG gunner, but you never actually had to go and do that.
No. Well, what I did do is I went to a massive live fire exercise in California called CACS. And in that, it was 40 days in the desert. And it was an extremely rigorous training. And by the final day, I had a very profound spiritual experience where I sort of experienced missing time. I saw a blinding light. And when it was all over with, I don't know how long it lasted. I would guess it probably lasted 30 minutes. And the guy next to me didn't seem to notice anything. And when it was all said and done, I was relieved of that
burden, that PTSD anger. Burden, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, it was gone. I just felt it very interesting. I thought it was, I mean, that was nothing short of a miracle for me. And it was an answer to my prayers. And ever since then, you know, I think I have normal anger, you know, but I've never had it as bad as I had then. And this was all before, this was all actually Columbine. Yeah, no, this was all before any of this happened in the public sphere. So by the time I remember, as soon as Columbine happened, immediately I had empathy for these kids in a sense. Like,
now,
I knew
Columbine was 1999, right? Was
yeah,
it 1999? Yeah.
1999. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was about 6-7 years after my experience in the desert. And so, you know, I don't want to make this about me, but I think that's what makes me somewhat of an expert.
Well, that's what connects you to this story.
These kids. Yeah. Right. So yeah. When I first heard about Columbine, my first thought was like, damn, someone did it. You know, someone actually did it. And it was tragic it's obviously tragic, but from someone who struggled with the thoughts as a child myself, I was just, it was very sad to see. And then as I got older, I started becoming more aware of the, you know, the psyops and the conspiracies behind it. And the fact that what we're seeing is really not all we think.
What was the first thing that you came across that you said, oh my God, that these kids might be part of this, or these kids might, you know, this might not just be random school shootings.
Well, I think at the time of Columbine, I remember hearing some of the reports come in that seemed very shady to me. And like I said, I always had a mind that questions things, and I don't trust things. So I remember catching it then, but it was probably when I read Behold a Pale Horse, which would have been really early 2000s is when I kind of started having my, you know, red pill awakening or whatever. And the first time I ever heard the suggestion that these things are, you know, government intelligence operations was in William Cooper's book. And it made sense to me. I know there's a reason why this stuff makes sense to me and it doesn't make sense to other people. And the main reason is because I experienced evil at a young age. And so it comes to no surprise to me that people would be willing to do this. It's no surprise at all. And I think where most people don't see it is because, well, there's two reasons. One is if they're lucky enough to have lived a blessed life where they never had to experience evil, a good-hearted person will just dismiss it because they
don't. Yeah, they don't have the reptilian brain, I call it.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about. Go ahead.
Well, just to finish my thought, as I've gotten older, I think I've realized that there's another reason, and that reason is there are people. So when you experience trauma as a child, there are different directions that you can go in. And when I believe what happened to me at the Jesuit house was some type of audition. I believe they were trying to see if I had it in me, if I had the psychopath gene in me. That's what I think.
Man, you know, that's very shocking to me because I know some Jesuits, and they're some of the finest human beings that I've ever encountered and most brilliant. So I think that, well, of course, all groups have their white hats and black hats, I guess. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and start talking about Milton Cooper, what he said, and what you perceived that was that made you think about these school shootings as psyops.
Jeremy Nell on TNT Radio.
If you've heard of the WHO's pandemic treaty, which if you haven't heard about it, then you're living under a cardboard box at the bottom of the ocean. But basically, it's a global coup. The WHO wants to take over sovereignty via the proxy of health. And they're trying to do this through getting countries around the world to agree. It's a very bad idea. But what's interesting is that Africa is leading the way. There's been a unanimous decision by a bunch of African countries, including members of BRICS, to reject this. What makes it fantastic for me is that it's coming from Africa, because Africa is notoriously this dark, uneducated continent. And I'm very, very proud of my fellow African countries who have taken this position to pretty much give the middle finger to the WHO. I think that right now, the failed state is dominating. We are winning.
Jeremy Nell and Germ Warfare on today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Mama, what does the chicken say? Dog. Cat. Giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
For the news and views you can't hear anywhere else, it's TNT Radio.
We're back with reporter Greg Reese, who has been covering the school shootings, has done some very interesting reporting on the mass school shootings. And he comes from a very unique perspective because he was traumatized as a young boy, and he recognized certain hallmarks in these kids. And he has brought his reporting up to looking into the possibility that these mass school shootings have connections, and one of them is possibly intelligence ops. And you mentioned Milton William Cooper, who wrote the book Behold a Pale Horse in 1991. He was a former naval intelligence officer turned whistleblower. And there are two things that he talked about, right? He talked about guns and he talked about the drugs. So talk about what he said about the government importing drugs, et cetera, and then talk about the school, the shootings, the mass shootings, and what he said he had observed.
Well, it was in his book. It was like a paragraph. It was really short. And it was very like in that book, he provided lots of documents for many things, but he didn't provide any documents for this. It was just sort of a blurb, which is interesting because he wrote it in 91. And, you know, SSRIs.
Right. It was an author's note. It was an author's note. And he wrote, I'll quote it. He says, I have found, and he's talking about these shootings. I have found that these events have indeed happened all over the country. In every instance that I have investigated, the incident at the women's school in Canada, the shopping center incident in Canada, the Stockton, California massacre and the murder of Rabbi Meir Kahane, the shooters were all ex-mental patients or were current mental patients who were all on Prozac. This drug, when taken in certain doses, increases the serotonin level in the patient, causing extreme violence. And he says, couple that with post-hypnotic suggestion or control through, he starts talking about brain implants or microwave, or I'm not sure what ELF intrusion is, but he's talking about, he's basically talking about MK Ultra stuff. So yes. That's what started you thinking about the possibility that this was that. But what specific details, and you did this video report that I found extremely interesting. That's why I called you up to put you on this show to discuss it, because there were some facts there that I hadn't known. You talked about what happened, what was going on with Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold before the shootings. Could you talk about some of the things that you found out?
Well, this is very interesting. It was, and I didn't really know this either until I was researching the report just recently, but there was, most of this comes from one of the victims of the shootings. His name is Mark. I can't think of his last name right now. And Mark has an extremely sad story. He was shot. He took 6 bullets to the chest and survived. He's one of the surviving students. And he started learning about a lot of facts of the case. And he actually helped bring a lawsuit against the drug companies and won and got, because they even said that one of the side effects is homicidal ideation. And the sad story about Mark was he kept going. He wrote a book where he was exposing what happened to the two boys. And after working on this book, they ended up institutionalizing him with no.
What book is that? What is the title of that book? And is it still available?
No, I don't. I don't think he ever actually finished it, because before he could actually finish it, they put him in an institution and they started putting him on the exact same drugs that he was fighting to get. I mean, it's a horrible story.
Who's they?
The lawyers involved. Let me see if I can find his name here.
By the way, as you're looking for that, I want to, there's a part of Milton William Cooper's, there's a final part to this author's note that I didn't read. He wrote, in every case, every case ends with the suicide of the perpetrator. In every case, the name of the murderer's doctor, of course, not suicide, sometimes the suicide of the perpetrator. In every case, the name of the murderer's doctor or mental treatment facility has been withheld. That's not entirely true, but certainly those mental health records are suppressed or not made public, as well as they try and keep out of the public what drugs they take. I believe we will be able, and then he writes finally, and I think this is where you are coming from, I believe we will be able to establish intelligence community connections and or connections to known CIA experimental mind control programs when we finally discover who these doctors of death really are. And he also says that the whole business of, first of all, the government has been trying to get guns into the hands of people. Okay. They have been importing drugs and selling them to people, mainly to the poor and minorities. And then he says, the government encouraged the manufacture and importation of military firearms for criminal use. This is intended to foster a feeling of insecurity, which would lead the American people to voluntarily disarm themselves by passing laws against firearms. Using drugs and hypnosis on mental patients in a process called Orion, the CIA inculcated the desire in these people to open fire on schoolyards and thus inflame the anti-gun lobby. This plan is well underway and so far is working perfectly. The middle class is begging the government to do away with the Second Amendment. And I'm like, oh my God, this was written in 1991.
Yeah.
That's what got my attention, honestly. I mean, that got my attention. And then some of these details that, did you find the details
yes.
that you were looking for on? Okay.
Yeah. His name is Mark Taylor. And he does have his book still on Amazon. His book is called I Asked, God Answered, A Columbine Miracle. And he, in 2004, he helped give testimony with some lawyers to file suit against the pharmaceutical companies, basically.
Yeah. Solvay Pharmaceutical. Yep.
And they ended up who they are exactly. I mean, I guess it would have been the pharmaceutical companies and their lawyers. And it's very shady and shy, and the details are not clear, but to this day, Mark Taylor is still institutionalized and being forced to take drugs very similar to the drugs that he worked so hard to get rid of. And there are videos of him all drugged up with his mother. And he's not a free man. It's a horrible story. I feel bad that I didn't get into it, but it just didn't pertain exactly. I was really wanting to focus on my intention for the video I did was I really wanted to show Columbine and then suggest that people go out and research all the other shootings because they're going to find.
Well, you can't. I think you should just keep going with your research because look, you can't. People always say that people should go out and look. They don't have the time, and a lot of people don't have the talent to do it. You know, I mean, people who do investigative work, that's a special breed of person, and if you're good at it, which I tell you, one thing that you brought up in your video talking about Taylor and his Solvay Pharmaceuticals case, John DeCamp, who's a lawyer, okay, you mentioned in your video that he disclosed what he learned in the Taylor versus Solvay Pharmaceuticals case. He said he wrote something about law enforcement using, and this was so bizarre. I think you should talk about it. Eric and Dylan were arrested. It's called the January incident. They were arrested before Columbine. Talk about what happened and then talk about what this lawyer, John DeCamp, discovered.
Well,
because that also fits into your story about why you think, oh, this might be, you know.
Well, the evidence shows, and there's a lot of people try to debunk it. There's actually a police report that I think they actually call the document the butt sex, which is really not funny, and it's sort of
funny.
Right, and the story, according to this, they were arrested for breaking into a car, and they were raped by the police officer, and they wrote about.
Wait, they were arrested for what? For
breaking into a car.
Okay, and they were taken to the police station. Where were their parents?
I don't know the details. There aren't a whole lot of details. Mostly, what we have is the police report that they drew that was, I guess, drawn by the victims or described by the victims as they were describing. And there's a, like a drawing that showed the scene that included what looked like a sodomized rape, which is also very strange. The other strange thing is a nearby sheriff. It wasn't in that county. I believe it was in the county next to that county. A nearby sheriff testified on the stand that admitted to raping informants and young men and was never.
Yeah. You know, Patrick Sullivan, Arapahoe right, County meth for exactly. sex sheriff, admits to using date rape drugs, may have had sex with teenage boys. I mean, how can that be a sheriff? How can that be? I mean, does that mean everybody in the office knows about this and, you know, are okay with it?
No, it means that it, I mean, this really, if you, in my opinion, if you want to know what's going on, you really have to look at the United Nations, the Alice Bailey 10-point plan for the United Nations for one world government. And it's all based on destroying Christianity. They make no bones about it. They want to destroy Christianity and replace it with a.
Well, that might be a bigger picture. That might be a bigger picture.
The only reason I mention it is because the point being is that we don't live in that society yet. We live in a society that's mostly Christian. And so these people have to hide. So that doesn't mean it doesn't mean people are bad. It doesn't mean all the Jesuits are bad. It doesn't mean all the sheriffs are bad. It means that there is a massive movement and these people have to hide. You know, they can't obviously be out in the open because normal people, I think we're normal. Normal people find this stuff extremely offensive. You know, it's criminal.
There's a lot of information coming out about certainly sex being used for trauma-based mind control is not a new concept. And no, you know, mind control, right. So, but I want to get back to these details because I think they're very important. This when they were arrested, they called it the January incident, right? And you wrote that, they were prescribed SSRI drugs at that point, while they were sent to juvenile diversion program. What is that?
Yes.
What is a juvenile diversion program?
Well, it's it was state sponsored, so it would have been, you know, local government. And in this diversion program, we know that they were prescribed. That's where they were prescribed the drugs that they were on.
Yeah, Eric Harris was on Luvox. Was he put on Luvox then? But he was on Luvox when yes. he was shot up the school.
Yeah, he was put it on. He was put it on basically a year and a half before Columbine incident in this diversion program.
And then Dylan Klebold, a friend of his. Now they have their medical records are suppressed. Dylan Klebold, a friend of his witnessed him taking Paxil and Zoloft together and urged him to get off them. And of course, Klebold's records are sealed. So these kids had this terrible experience. Okay. And
they wrote about again, it, and they wrote about killing the pigs. So they're,
yes.
When they wrote about the January incident, they weren't talking about students at the school. They were talking about getting revenge on the cops.
Right. Now, and let's be clear. It was lawyer John DeCamp who said that law enforcement used the boys, Eric and Dylan, for their own sexual needs and purposes. And this was after the January incident. The boys were arrested for breaking into a van and later sodomized. Okay. And Eric wrote in Dylan's yearbook, quote, "My wrath for the January incident will be godlike. We'll have so much fun blowing up stuff and killing cops." And he underlined killing cops. So that's a lawyer talking about this, you know. So that's kind of shocking.
One thing I think to mention also, you asked where the parents were. Now, I'm not indicting anyone's parents. I don't know anything specific. But one thing you will find in a lot of these cases, not just Columbine, is the families are often families of the military industrial complex. This whole town that they grew up in is a fairly new town, and it was built up around Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin had a missile development factory there. And this was basically the families of the employees of Lockheed Martin. And so there is something, I think there is something to be said about that, that, I mean, throughout all this MK Ultra stuff, you're going to find children of the military. If you look into the whole Laurel Canyon story.
What about their parents? I mean, I'm trying to think of myself as a parent of one of these kids. And I just, I mean, where are their parents?
Let me read a quote. This is a famous quote. A lot of people have heard it. I don't think it's been proven whether or not he said it or not, but I think this kind of answers it a bit. This is a J. Edgar Hoover quote, allegedly. The individual comes face to face with a conspiracy so monstrous, he cannot believe it exists. The American mind has not come to a realization of the evil which has been introduced into our midst. It rejects even the assumption that human creatures could espouse a philosophy which must ultimately destroy all that is good and decent. And so whether or not he actually said that, that says it all. One of the ways they're able to pull the hood over us and fool us and keep us blind to this.
Yeah, the crime is so huge. It's incredulous. People are incredulous. Right. The crime and evil is so great that people can't wrap their minds around it. So they don't think it exists. It's possible. I think that,
yeah.
I think the veil is lifting a little bit because there's no hiding the fact anymore. For example, the global pedophilia that went on in the Catholic Church for all these years, you know, all these children, all these priests involved in this, finally getting exposed. So we have to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about Adam Lanza and Sandy Hook. We'll be back right after this. This is TNT Radio Live.
Vax manufacturers love vaccine mandates. Why? Because they make a lot of money.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
In Davos at the World Economic Forum Summit in 2022, Moderna CEO Stéphane Bancel praised French President Macron's courage in making his company a lot of money.
Fun. Do I make you French for the purposes of this exercise? Or,
so if you make me French, I will give an A for Mr. Macron for the courage to putting the pass at the end of the summer last year, which I thought was fantastic. And you saw the vaccine uptake went up like crazy.
Yes, nothing like courageous politicians doing the bidding of Big Pharma to make them a lot more money by mandating their product to the entire population. This is how the Great Reset works. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Get breaking news on your phone when it happens. Download our app from the Google Play and App Store now.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, we're back. I'm talking to Greg Reese about school shootings and the possible connections between the school shootings and, intelligence ops. And we're also talking about other similarities among all these shootings. So let's... You know, another weird thing you put in your video, I just want to mention it because it was so bizarre. This is World Edition, I guess, it's LA Times staff writer, April 27th, 1999, who said that Jefferson County Sheriff John Stone earlier told reporters the goal of the killers, Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris, that their goal was to strike during the busy lunch hour to go for a big kill. But in an interview published today in the Denver Post, Stone said the gunman's diary indicates that if they survived, they wanted more, to hijack an airplane and crash it into a major city. He said New York City was their target. That was so bizarre.
Yeah.
This is LA Times. This is from an LA Times reporter. It's in the World. I mean, what? Does that weird you out in some very special way?
Well, I mean, there's many levels to it. One, you could search, what do they call it? I can't remember their terms for it, but you can find hours of things that show 9/11 sort of being predicted before it ever happened. You know, the one that comes to mind immediately.
Well, I just find it weird that these school shooters, yeah. Oh, I know that, but shooters, it was just sort of a weird thing that I wanted to throw in there. Cause
I would say, I mean, this is
fascinating.
What my gut tells me is that's evidence that they were involved in MK Ultra. That's what my gut tells me. I mean, where did they hear that from? Where did they get that idea from? You know,
God, it's so weird. So you said, an honest investigation of school shootings after Columbine will have the same signatures, and you described the signatures. Could you talk about that, the families involved in the military? You talked about the families involved in the military-industrial complex. Talk about the other ones.
Well, the main one is the SSRI. You're going to find these kids are on drugs.
Right.
You're going to refresh my memory. I said families in the
military. You said SSRIs and other prescribed psychotropic drugs. Psychological care provided by the state.
Yes, exactly. They're going to have a handler. They're going to, in almost every case, you're going to see that they're connected to a handler. You know, back in the day, in the 70s and the Oklahoma City bombing and all this, there was actually the same handler for a lot of these people back in the day. Jolly was his name.
Handler from what? A CIA or FBI?
Yes. And he was
which one?
Well, he was a private psychiatrist. I don't think he was necessarily associated with the CIA. No, he was. He did work with the CIA. Yeah, he was a known psychologist. I'm Googling his name right now, for the CIA MK Ultra programs. Dr. Jolly West, Louis Julian West. Okay. His nickname is Jolly, which is pretty creepy. And who was he connected to? Well, he was Timothy McVeigh's psychiatrist. He was
interesting.
I don't want to misquote it. A whole handful. But it's a little obvious these days. But you will find something similar. You will find that these people are all, you know, they have a handler of some sort. They have a doctor who's prescribing those meds and who's probably.
But where are their kids? Are you talking about the school shooters too, having their
own? Yeah. Are the parents? Well, that's why I bring up families in the military industrial complex. And I'm not saying that every family involved in building weapons of mass destruction and murder are evil people. I'm not saying that, but it would make sense that you're going to be able to find people in that line of work. That are
are you calling their kids weapons of mass destruction? Are you calling their kids?
I'm saying that the parents are. That's their career, is making weapons that.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. They're making a living, and I'm not. Once again, this isn't. Well, I don't actually feel that bad. You know, criticizing the military industrial complex. So I'll take that back. But when you think about that, the type of person that's going to make a living off of mass murder, which is what it is, these people probably don't see life as precious as the rest of us. They probably don't see even their own children. They probably don't see as precious as the rest of us do. I mean, we're not all good-hearted people.
I don't want to think that, and I don't want to paint them all with a broad black brush. But
I'm not
hearing
that either.
I hear
what
you're
saying. Is it's a trend? I am saying it's a trend.
I hear
what
you're saying.
You will make of it.
I hear what you're saying. The other thing that you said, which I thought was very interesting, and I've seen this in other cases, associations with law enforcement prior to the shootings, and you mentioned. I think you mentioned Peyton Gendron, I think is his name. Could you talk about that?
I don't think I.
He was a, well, I'll tell you because I, there was a retired federal agent. This was the Buffalo gunman, right?
Ah, yes. Okay, and, right. Yes.
And his name was Peyton Gundren, and he frequented an online chat room where racist hatred was discussed. And apparently two law enforcement sources with direct knowledge of this investigation of Peyton Gundren after his shooting said that Gundren invited these cops to read about his mass shooting plans and target location 30 minutes before he went and killed people. This was at Tops Market. He killed people on May 14th, 2022. So this is quite recent in Buffalo, New York. He went to a Tops Friendly Markets supermarket and he killed 10 black people and three other people were injured. And he live streamed part of the attack on Twitch.
And the live stream was sort of coached on how to live stream by these cops. You know, they were
what?
You know, checking.
How do you know that?
Well, this was in the, you can Google, this is I think pretty well documented. This is in the articles that are on the even mainstream, you know, alternative mainstream media, but that the in the chat room part of the chat was checking in with like make, you know, bit rate, you know, nothing incriminating, just learning how to making sure that you get the live stream right, you know, making sure you know how to do it so that it streams right and all that stuff. And now it's coming out that it wasn't just one ex-Fed. It seems like everyone in the chat room other than the kid were federal agents.
Oh, my God. You know, that really makes me sick to my stomach because, of course, there's so many cases where, including the first World Trade Center bombing, including Whitey Bulger, you know, where the feds basically and they had informants right in there, or they themselves were part, you know, they themselves were with the informant and they just let these crimes, these horrific crimes happen. So
it seems, you know, like
this implicates
job.
The FBI. Really,
yeah.
This implicates the FBI right along with the CIA that you're implicating, right?
100%. Well, I did a report on the history of the FBI. I mean, I don't know what the FBI has done other than commit crimes. I mean, if you really look at their history going all the way back, I mean, both the CIA and the FBI, CIA seems to be a more international organization, whereas the FBI is more domestic, but they're both running high crimes.
Well, I mean, I've done extensive reporting on that, the criminal activities. Certainly of the FBI. I've had plenty of FBI whistleblowers on, and I mean, it's absolutely crazy how they are involved in covering up a lot of the Epstein case is a primary example right now. And in these school shooter cases, this is the thing. Whenever it happens, you know, before we talk about Lanza, we should talk about Uvalde, because you can see how very strange circumstances from start to finish with this event. Okay. And you find that the information is being suppressed. You find that lies and misinformation is being put out there. You find that the right questions, nobody, have you heard anybody ask, was this kid on drugs? Nobody.
Nobody has asked
that. Yeah. And you know what's interesting? Did you hear that his body was not taken to the local coroner? His body was secreted to some other coroner, someplace else, allegedly for security purposes, okay? And then the toxicology report, something that should be available, this would be a top priority. I mean, within 2 weeks, it should be available. And they have announced that it will not be available for 4 months. So I think there's something really smelly going on. We'll talk about what you think is smelly. We're gonna take a little break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Uvalde and we'll talk about Sandy Hook and Adam Lanza.